You're listening to a special series of expert voices. In each episode, Riviera Maritime Media and Lloyd's Register bring together subject matter experts to share their insights on the technical, operational, and commercial issues shaping the marine and offshore industries. Our host is Riviera Maritime Media's Edwin Lampert.
A very warm welcome, everyone, to today's podcast on Greening the Workhorses of the Sea, the Path to Zero Carbon Bulk Carriers. I'm your moderator, Edwin Lampert, Riviera's Executive Editor and Head of Business Relations. The dry bulk shipping industry faces immense pressure to decarbonize operations and meet stringent emissions regulations in the coming years, yet the path ahead remains highly complex and uncertain. Today, we'll discuss the various strategies and technologies bulk carrier owners can implement to green their fleets while remaining commercially viable. But we'll also consider the very real limitations and barriers that must be overcome to enable this transition. To help unpack this complex issue, I'm pleased to be joined by two experts, Nikos Kakalis, Global Bulk Carriers Segment Director at Lloyd's Register, and Scott Bergeron, Managing Director of Global Engagement and Sustainability at Oldendorf Carriers. So coming to you first, Scott, you have famously referred to today's situation as a little bit of a lottery for the owner when it comes to the technology. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think my expressions in the past is choosing the lottery winner, right? When we're faced with this global energy challenge, which is exactly what this is, it's not just a shipping problem, it's not just a dry bulk problem, but it's a global energy challenge. I think it's patently unfair for the ship owner, him or herself, to have to choose which is the right fuel, which is the right way forward. So there's a lot of ambition. There's a lot of willingness and recognition that we need to improve to reduce our carbon emissions. But as you've said in the introduction, the pathway is not exactly clear. And I'm not convinced that it's solely the ship owner's responsibility to choose the right path.
So Scott, Nikos, if it's patently unfair and it's unclear, how do we pragmatically bridge the gap between ambitions and commercially viable decarbonization solutions for bulk shipping? And what role can stakeholders like charterers play in closing this gap?
I think it's far from easy to discuss and to answer these questions. Charterers are an important part of the equation, and I think we see some of the bigger charters trying to experiment on technologies that can improve fuel consumption, can improve energy efficiency. And I think this is a very, very important part as one of the key actions in the industry today.
So, Edwin, I think the key is exactly what you say, practical, pragmatic, the word you used. This is what ship owners, charters can work on together. We have to set realistic goals, and we have to choose metrics that are appropriate for achieving those goals. And this is very much what Oldendorf has been doing with some of our clients, the different commodity interests. They have their own ESG ambition, goals, if you will. And what we do is we work together on their trade lanes, on their commodity contracts, and we find ways to achieve a reduction that's both practical and achievable, and using the type of metric that is going to achieve the objective. So, for example, with one of our clients, they have contracts to move millions of tons of their commodity from here to there. So what we've done is we've looked at what they've done in the past. You know, if you had, for example, 3 million tons that you need to move, how did you do that historically? And how much carbon emissions were there associated with those movements? Was it over 100 voyages, 50 voyages, 20 voyages? What size ships? What speeds? How much fuel was used? And then we tried to re-envision that program and those liftings. And what can we do to reduce the amount of carbon per tons carried or tons shipped? So it's just a very practical approach at looking at the movement, understanding what the objective was to reduce the carbon by specific amounts, and then working a program where that makes sense. And it might involve the low-hanging fruit of slowing the ships down. But that's not always the answer that the commodity interests want to hear, because if you're just using speed reduction, then you might have to put more ships into the freight program. And have we achieved anything if we're slowing down but adding more ships because we have a time period to move that much cargo from here to there? So it has to be beyond that, beyond just speed reduction. Maybe it's upsizing the cargo, putting the same amount of cargo on a fewer number of ships by larger shipments. But that's not always as easy as can be done. You know, there's stockpiling issues, there's offtake agreements, there's port restrictions, draft restrictions, things of that nature. So then you have to go deeper and you have to pick away at all of the different tools that we have today. And there are many. So this is the approach, I think, that both owners and charters can work on together in a very practical way, as you mentioned.
And Scott, picking up on the themes of going deeper, working together, metrics, the charter, and reducing carbon emissions, what operational and commercial challenges do you see emerging from the IMO's carbon intensity indicator rules? And how can charterers and owners work together under CII to optimize voyages while aligning incentives?
Yeah, I think the intent of the CII regulation is correct. It's, as you say, working together, the different interests of a voyage. However, we've come out publicly as Oldendorf Carriers to criticize the metric that's being used currently with the CII. The metric that the IMO is using, the CII or Carbon Intensity Indicator, is the AER or Annual Efficiency Ratio.
Nikos, owners face a balancing act between investing in decarbonization today versus risk of stranded asset values. What commercial mechanisms and incentives, to your mind, are needed from charterers to properly value and share these investments?
Again, this is not an easy question to answer because, to my opinion, the whole thing is being dictated by the market. So once we have the need for a certain amount of cargo to be transported, then the market will pick the ships that are relevant and the cargo will be transported. And I think regarding incentives, perhaps, Scott, from your side, acting from both sides, what would you consider?
You know, as a commercial entity, we want to operate on a capital system, I think, a capitalist mindset, right? Things have to make economic sense. And when we talk about sustainability, an important part of sustainability is that a company can continue to be an ongoing concern. It's sustainable in the economic sense. As such, at least from Oldendorf Carrier's perspective, we're not a type of company that's looking for government handouts, type of financial incentives. This should be driven commercially, and there should be commercial incentives that motivate us in our behavior. That said, you can't work in a just pure economic vacuum, and there are regulatory incentives. I think some of the work that's being done slowly, for sure, but these ideas of using fund and reward mechanisms, using cap and trade, whether it's an ETS type model, but has to be on a global scale and not a regional scale, that these type of tools will help level the cost of new fuels against the cost of the current existing fuels. And that's something that we think can prove to be very, very effective.
Can I go back to CII? Because I think that this is really a game changer for our industry. And of course, our segment that has transshipping as its major characteristic is also massively affected. So, CII focuses a lot of energy efficiency. It is indeed an operational measure. I fully agree that it is in the right direction. However, in fact, it touches a wider spectrum and not only the operations, including how it is deployed in terms of routes and how it is operated by the charter, but also affecting the hardware of the ship, which technology is installed, how efficient the ship was designed and how well maintained it is. But it also affects other aspects like crew training, the human factor we have on board, in terms of familiarization with new systems and the fuels that you touched upon before, Scott, but also in terms of focus on fuel consumption and efficiency. And I do reckon that this is a very important dimension that is rarely touched upon. And knowing how quality owner and operator is Oldendorf, I would like also to have your thought about that.
It's undoubted that the operation of ships on board is becoming more and more complex over time. I think we've gone through a phase now in the late 90s, early part of this century, where there's a lot of administrative work, right? Checklists and a lot of third-party vetting and coming on board the ships and inspecting. And that was a big distraction for the crew and preventing them, I think, from being quality seafarers and becoming a bit more administrators. If we look ahead at some of the more sophisticated fuels being suggested for the future, like ammonia being one of them, this is a gas type fuel rather than a liquid fuel. So the competency, the understanding of chemical and science is becoming more and more relevant, especially if we talk about dry bulk, right? So, I mean, obviously the industry already has gas carriers and we have these complex ships already moving these type of gases as cargo. But it's a altogether different game, if you will, to power the ships with these types of fuels, whether it's an LNG or ammonia or anything else that we're talking about, even molten salt reactor nuclear, if that does come in 15 or 20 years from now. So we're going to have comprehensive upgrade of the capability, understanding, and so forth of the crew on board. Now, some of that may be offset. You know, if you're burning different types of fuel and the engines aren't needing as much maintenance and attention as the ones we have today, you know, these may offset each other. But I think your point is that, you know, there has to be an upgrading. And this is something that can't be underestimated when we're talking about the crew of the ships.
Scott, you've brought up the subject of fuels. You've previously expressed doubts about the readiness of ammonia as a future marine fuel, and you have cited safety concerns. Can you elaborate on the specific safety risks of ammonia that give you pause for thought? And from your point of view, what would need to happen from a technology and regulation standpoint to address these risks?
Yeah, I mean, I think ammonia by its chemical nature is most likely a mobile form of energy of the future. We know, for example, in Japan, they're going forward far ahead, both in the power industry and in shipping, looking at ammonia. Australia is focused on developing a lot of green ammonia as a supply source. But when we talk about ammonia, I mean, we just cannot lose sight of the toxicity issue. And when you think about the traditional ship structure, you have an open engine room, an environment where crew are operating every day. And then above the engine room on most ships, you know, is the accommodation where the crew is living. There is such a thing as uncombusted fuel. There is such a thing as emitting some of the uncombusted fuel out into the atmosphere through the funnel of the ship. There's such a thing as fuel leaks. When you put all this together and you look at some of the modeling of the escape of unburnt ammonia, whether it's through some type of leak before combustion or some type of uncombusted release of the fuel, you're suddenly putting in the environment where people are operating or living something very toxic. And we're talking about, you know, very small number of parts per million before it affects the human body. So these are the you know, the very broad nature, like issues that have to be addressed. And there are some studies, the Lloyd's Register and the Maersk Decarbonization Center, the Center for Zero Emissions, you know, have done a study and they've labeled the use of ammonia as a fuel as tolerable. I personally think that's somewhat of an unfortunate expression, that the risks are tolerable. I find that very difficult to try to recruit engineers to work on a ship where you can tell them, don't worry, the risk is tolerable. We need to do better than that. And probably what it means is a fundamental redesign of where things are on board the ship. You know, are we talking about some type of a hermetically type sealed engine room where crew are not working in that environment? Is the engine room going to be somewhere different on the ship than the accommodation? So these are things that are being worked on, and I'm not a naval architect. I have the responsibility to be concerned about my colleagues, the people that we work together with and we rely to serve on board the ships. So I need to be willing to go in these environments before I ask our crew to do that.
Nikos, obviously managing risk, design, this is all very much your wheelhouse. Listening to Scott's remarks, what's your take?
Look, green ammonia is a fuel that has a lot of potential as an alternative sustainable fuel. Of course, the adoption of a new technology or alternative fuel, it's not only a matter of techno-economics, but it's also a matter of safety. And rules and regulations are there to support and ensure that safety is managed in the best and absolute way. For sure, we are not there yet in terms of having seen the first ammonia fuel bulk carrier vessels delivered and actually operated to start building hands-on experience. But all in all, I fully agree that safety is the absolutely most important thing, and then the techno-economics, and then everything else.
So, Nikos, you've alluded to the challenges of ordering an ammonia-powered new build today. And Scott, in amongst your earlier answer, you referenced Australia. So two things come to mind from my side. First of all, when it comes to ordering a new bulk carrier for delivery in 5 years, what fuel propulsion specifications would you lean towards, and would you opt for fuel flexibility? That's the first thing that comes to mind. And secondly, having mentioned Australia, there's all this talk and focus on a West Australia, East Asian iron ore green corridor. To what extent is this within reach, and how do you regard green corridors in the round? Perhaps Scott.
So when it comes to ordering ships, I think, you know, again, we have to come back to reality and what's practical. Just like an automobile or an aircraft, a ship, you can order what's available to buy. Yes, you know, certain owners or projects can inspire some type of novel design, but the way we do business is very practical, and we're going to order ships where there's a specification that's available and ready to order. That's a commercial and economic approach to ordering and buying ships from the shipyard. So if you're asking me today what type of ship are we going to order for, you know, the next 5 years, first of all, the slots are full for the types of ships that we're ordering and buying. There's not a lot of availability inside of 2 or 3 years. So we're already 2 or 3 years out, and there's a lot of technology that's expected to change in the next 5 years. That said, I think as a commercial strategy, options are worth an investment. And if you can have an option to have a dual fuel vessel that's going to meet your objectives, then that's something that's very interesting to look at if the price of that option makes sense in the big scheme of things. But from today's standpoint, for example, if you're talking about dual fuel methanol ship, there is not the right size methanol engine for a Capesize ship. It doesn't exist. So they have, I think it's 110 bore size engine. These are the size engines that Maersk are putting on their large 20,000 TEU container ships. And then you have the smaller size engine. I think it's a 50 or 60 bore methanol engine that fits, you know, medium range tankers, Supra, maybe some of the smaller Panamax size ships. So for us, a dual fuel methanol engine is not available. There's no specification for such a ship. Similarly with ammonia, the engines just aren't ready. There's no specification today where you can order a bulk carrier powered by ammonia because it doesn't exist yet. So that's my first question. You know, we're there, ready, willing, waiting, but what we need isn't available in the market. Switching to the question about green corridors, again, you know, we talked about incentives and motivation, and I believe the green corridor is a interesting tool. We're involved in two different types of green corridors. The one you referenced, ammonia, Australia trade. This is typically referred to the Capesize as the C5, which is Australia to China, iron ore type trade. It's a good tool. What you're doing with a green corridor is ring fencing the trade itself and bringing the stakeholders, the different parties, whether it's the charterer, the ship owner, the receivers, the regulatory authorities, the fuel supply, all these different parties that are going to be involved in the collective voyage, bringing them together. And by ring fencing them and bringing it together, you're reducing risk, right? So you're focusing, you're bringing commitments, and you're experimenting and then proving concept in a trade where you're not worried about the overall global risks that might occur, like where are we going to get the fuel? If you're just focused on a particular trade lane, you can set up the contracts and get the fuel between the ports rather than worrying about global access of fuel, rather than worrying about global requirements at the port and municipal level, rather than worrying about what the different contract partners are going to think and do and compete against each other with the different market forces. So we are very enthusiastic about green corridors as part of this transition, and to use that type of tool and mechanism, bring the parties together in a way that, again, makes practical sense.
Nikos, some bulk carrier owners are exploring onboard carbon capture technologies like exhaust gas cleaning systems that absorb CO2. What's your perspective on the readiness and viability of these technologies today, and how might they fit into a future fuel mix?
I personally think that onboard carbon capture and temporary storage is one part of the solution. The technology in terms of the chemistry, allow me to say that, is there, and it is a technology that is being marinized from the onshore industry. What is not there yet is the full value chain. So imagine an owner decides to install such a system on board, and imagine that all the different bits and pieces on board can be fitted, in which port reception facilities we are going to offload the captured CO2, in which price we are going to sell the captured CO2, and so on and so forth. So I think the entire value chain needs to be established before we see concepts like that being materialized. Having said that, I strongly believe that CCS will be part of the solution. Not perhaps for all the routes, not perhaps for all the vessels, but definitely some part of it will have it.
Sticking with Nikos and technology, if I may, let's dig deeper into some of the key wind propulsion technologies like rotor sails, kites, and Flettner rotors. Where are we seeing these technologies prove most promising for large bulk carriers in your view? And what are some of the key limitations today in scaling them more widely?
I think, you know, having dealt again as with first CCS systems, but also with first Flettner rotor systems retrofitting, I think that this is an interesting system. We have not seen yet a very widespread adoption of such technology, I think for various reasons. First is because it's at the beginning and the cost is quite high. And second is that there are some possible limitations when it comes to routes and particular trades that such technologies have maximum efficiencies. So I think that down the line, when we see more applications like that, which will mean that the cost will be reduced, then these technologies will be much more applicable. It's interesting to note that Oldendorf and Lloyd's Register, we have worked together on a joint development project for something along these lines in the recent past, and thereby perhaps Scott has his opinion as well.
I'd like to go back to carbon capture, just because I think it's an important point. Mm. Carbon capture is interesting, but it's about the waste stream. And it's a little bit of deja vu. I've seen this movie before. We talked about sulfur and reducing sulfur from the fuel. This is IMO 2020, right? So only going back three and a half years. And what happened is there's a few different solutions to solve the sulfur problem, one of which was scrubbers. And then what do you do with the waste scrubber? And everyone was happy to see removal of sulfur one way or the other. But then once the scrubbers came on the market, then they moved the goal line and they want to, you know, what are we doing with the sulfur? We can't put this in the ocean. In spite of science, there's a lot of fear that, oh, this is bad. And I think the same thing will occur with carbon capture. What are you doing with the carbon? I understand that these ideas to deposit the carbon back into the earth, either subsea or in the caves and cracks and crevices of the world in places like Norway. But, you know, what if there's an earthquake? What if these breach open and the carbon somehow is emitted? I just wonder, how does this story end? You know, if you don't want it to begin with, don't put it on the ship. So I think there are a lot of work to be done on the waste stream of carbon capture. With regard to the flattener, it is interesting, but only to a degree. We have to remember that we still need favorable winds for these technologies, whether it's the flattener rotors or the different type of wing sails. So the benefit of this technology, which should be captured, it's just not universal, particularly in a tramping type trade where you just don't have consecutive routes back and forth. That being said, we are involved in a wind assist project, and it'll be announced soon. And it's against a trade lane where there are favorable winds consistently. So we're optimistic about that. But from a business case, the break-even period is forecasted to be very long. So until prices come down or technology improves where you can have a better benefit, it's not going to be the home run that everybody wants it to be. Certainly, it'll save some fuel, but it's not giving you the break-even. It's not giving you the economic story that's going to make this widespread, unless if it can be done in a trade where you can rely on the favorable winds.
Nikos, if, as Scott says, wind is interesting, but only to a degree, beyond wind, what role can waste heat recovery systems play in improving energy efficiency for bulk carriers, main engines and auxiliary engines? And what are some of the challenges in implementing these systems effectively?
Edwin, yes, indeed. Waste heat recovery systems and shaft generators for larger ships in particular, as well as variable frequency drives, contribute with efficiency gains. And we should not forget that nowadays, hull appendages like newest ducts or Bosca fins are given, as well as advanced antifouling paints can also have a quite positive benefit in terms of fuel consumptions and thus greener operation.
No discussion in this area should fail to take in digitalization. I'm sure you agree, Scott. So my question for you, and obviously we want to hear from Nikos as well, is how can digitalization amplify efforts around voyage optimization? And you mentioned slow steaming earlier through data sharing and performance monitoring.
Digitization, what does it actually mean? I mean, it's the advancement of technology. It's using different forms of computers, algorithms, artificial intelligence now. It's the way of the future, right? So one of the things Oldendorf is doing is we've started to install Starlink communication systems on our ships. And this is opening up, you know, to a much greater extent the amount of bandwidth that's available on each ship. Oftentimes people who are not in shipping might forget that the ocean is still vast and big, and it's not easy to communicate with the ships like it is on land. And sometimes you have to remind yourself of that. But Starlink looks to be another game changer, much as VSAT was in the last 10 years, where you're getting more reliable communication capability and data exchange with the ships. And for us, this is already inspiring us. What can be done once we have reliable and broadband with each ship? How can this be used to a safety advantage, an economic advantage, an environmental advantage? So I don't have all the answers yet, but I can say it starts with having better connectivity with the ships. It's then followed by having better real-time understanding of what's happening on board the ship, whether it's high-frequency sensors and ocean conditions. And then once you can see and feel and measure in real time, then you can adjust accordingly. And once you do that, whether it's a safety issue or an environmental issue or just overall efficiency issue, then you're in a position to make those adjustments. And then going back on the idea of the artificial intelligence, or how can we use these computer systems and algorithms to optimize the voyage, just as you say, you know, once we're measuring and making the adjustments, how can we make the most effective adjustments? So I think it's pretty exciting to have this type of assistance so the crew can focus on being great seafarers and having the benefit that many of us ashore take for granted of having these tools in place just to make everything more efficient.
Yeah, from my side, I think that it's a super exciting field, and artificial intelligence and digitalization are here to assist us, really, really support our seafarers and improve in all different aspects of performance and efficiency. I'd like to particularly point out what Scott said about the fidelity of the data that we capture on board. That's a very, very important issue. We need to be sure that what we're going to receive in the office as data is the real picture. So that's really one chapter, one big chapter of technologies like that. And the other is how we use this data to derive useful insights. That's another thing that is extremely important to consider. What are the things that we want to measure? What are the things that we want to infer from these measurements in order to have tangible knowledge about what happens on board? And the last point I'd like to make on that is that CII that we touched upon before is perhaps a very, very good door opener to accelerate the adoption of such technologies, because during the course of the operation of a ship, during the period of a charter party agreement, a ship owner would like to have an as good as possible understanding of how the ship is being operated. And the best way to do it is to have a good and trustworthy performance monitoring tool.
I think what we can infer from this discussion is, while complex barriers remain, pragmatic optimism is warranted given steady advances in wind propulsion, waste energy recovery systems, voyage optimization, and other technologies to drive efficiency gains in the near and medium term. The end goal of net zero emissions, as we've heard today, will require a complex symphony of stakeholders across shipping, energy, and government to align on fuel availability, infrastructure, and crucially, safety standards for future green fuel. Thank you again to Nikos and Scott for their insights. I'm confident that this discussion has shed light for our audience on the multifaceted journey ahead to green the vital workhorses of the sea. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for listening to this podcast, part of a series brought to you by Riviera Maritime Media and Lloyd's Register. To share feedback on this episode and propose future topics, please email expert.voice@lr.org and edwin.lampert@rivieramm.com. To stay up to date on the technical and operational issues shaping the marine and offshore industries, please visit the Lloyd's Register and Riviera websites, www.lr.org and www.rivieramm.com.